charming Father Abram, 300,000 more. From Mississippi's winding stream and from New England's shore. Relieve our plows and workshops, our wives and children dear. With hearts too full for utterance, with but a silent tear. We dare not look behind us, but stand as he before. We are counting Father Abram, 300,000 more. We are counting, counting our union to restore. We are counting Father Abram with 300,000 more. We are counting, counting our union to restore. We are counting Father Abram with 300,000 more.
Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government, tore down the government, tore down the government. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government, tore down the government, tore down the government. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government many long years ago. But old Abe Lincoln built up a better one, built up a better one, built up a better one. Old Abe Lincoln built up a better one many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Abe Lincoln built up a better one many long years ago.
No white man.
In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free.
While God is marching on,
glory, glory, hallelujah.
In our great national conflict, Lincoln noted as its ending approached, both parties read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty, Lincoln confessed, has his own purposes. No other United States president, I venture, surpasses Lincoln's reflections on the religious meaning of politics. In some measure, no doubt, he was compelled to such thoughts because he held the office when ultimate questions were starkly raised by political events. The Republic itself was put on trial by the schism of civil war. Still, on my reading, Lincoln's religious reckoning with politics and war also exhibits his character as a man for whom our ultimate context provides the fitting and proper setting in which to interpret events and to participate in them. At the least, profound religious sensibilities mark the man as he now lives in our national memory. And surely this results in part from Lincoln's use of biblical allusions and religious symbols in giving singular eloquence to his own interpretations. Recall, for instance, his appeal to the better angels of our nature at the end of his first inaugural address in 1860, as seven states in the South claim to withdraw from the Union. "I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature."
That's Franklin I. Gamwell, Chris Gamwell, who is Shaler Matthews Distinguished Service Professor of Religious Ethics, the Philosophy of Religions, and Theology in the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. And he was reading for us the opening paragraphs of a paper he gave recently on Lincoln and the religious question. I'm Andrew Patner. The program, the series, is Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered, a co-production with the Chicago History Museum and with generous funding from Motorola Foundation here on 98.7 WFMT in Chicago and on WFMT.com. This paper came to my attention because a neighbor and friend of mine was at an event where you gave the paper, Mr. Gamwell, and this was not a scholarly gathering, and I gather from initial correspondence with you about doing this program that you did not come to this study, and it's a fascinating one and a beautifully written one and a brief one. You did not come to this study directly from your day-to-day academic work in that you are not an historian of the United States and you are not necessarily focused on a day-to-day basis on whether presidents professed religious faith or did not.
That states it exactly. I teach and think about theology and religious ethics and therefore the contemporary world. I am, at best, an admirer of Abraham Lincoln, and I attend to his life and his thought as an avocation, but can make no pretense to being an historian, much less a scholar of his life and thought.
But because you do think about those things, because you do think about philosophy, you think about religion, and you think about politics and society and the way those things come together, so that gives you not just a cast of mind but years of experience in doing this. And you also have a knowledge of religious texts and their uses, at least Christian and Old and New Testament, as the Christians would say, references that sometimes, particularly in a contemporary society or in secular parts of that society, might pass some people by. They might even think that some of these phrases that Lincoln uses originated with Lincoln, when in fact they're very often quotations or paraphrases, sometimes direct quotations from the King James Bible.
Absolutely. You're generous in your characterization of what I know, but it is the case that my interests in philosophy and theology or the relation between religion and politics is a principal reason why I find Lincoln so fascinating, because I do think that he was so uncommon in the depth of his reflections on the relation between religion and politics, and so uncommon in his purchase on the Bible and his use of allusions to the Bible or to other religious symbols to have an effect on an audience that was often very conversant with the Bible itself. I expect that there are many Americans who think that the metaphor of the house divided, a metaphor that he made such good use of in the famous house divided speech, many people think that metaphor is one he coined, when in fact it's an allusion to the Gospel of Mark, who first offers the metaphor of the house divided.
We're going to come to that, and it's a key part of this whole set of reflections that you've put together here. We'll come to that in just a moment. I like, though, to ask our guests on this series a naive question at the beginning, and that is, which you can answer from any perspective you like, but who was Abraham Lincoln?
That, in some ways, I suppose, is the question nobody really knows the answer to. He was, by testimony of those who supposedly knew him best at the time, a very private man. And I recall reading somewhere that a man named Judge Davis, who traveled with Lincoln when they both were lawyers in Illinois prior to Lincoln's presidency, said he'd never met a man who was more private or about whom one could know so little. So who was Abraham Lincoln is very difficult to know. What we have is the public Lincoln. We have the Lincoln who was a congressman, who was a lawyer, who gave a lot of speeches, was very active in Illinois politics, and then obviously was president at a critical time in the history of this nation. But I think who was Abraham Lincoln in the sense that we often ask that about people and we mean what defines them internally as individuals is probably a question the answer to which will always be surely speculative.
A related question, which is one that you begin the investigative part of your paper with, is one that has been discussed literally from Lincoln's youth unto the present day, and that was, did Lincoln himself have or profess a particular faith as we would understand it when we fill out a form or the census, Roman Catholic, Hindu, Baha'i, Baptist, Christian, atheist? And maybe the answer to that question is similar to the answer to the more general question that we just talked about.
It may be similar. We may not know entirely, but I think the answer to that is a little clearer. At least I think there is a consensus among historians with respect to that question. I have no doubt that Lincoln was a theist, that Lincoln had a profound belief that the meaning and ultimate worth of human life are given by the whole of reality from which we all come and to which we all go, and that he associated as a creator very early in his life, and that he called God throughout his life. So no question that he was a theist. That he was ever a Christian, that would be the choice for him to make. That he was ever a confessing Christian seems to me highly dubious. He was a religious inquirer. He wanted to know what this whole of reality was, and he especially wanted to know that because he associated with it a moral order given in the nature of things. And that was important to him because he had to find out what his responsibilities were. He had a strong sense of moral obligation. So he inquired about the nature of God and the moral order God gives. But his friends in that inquiry were reason and evidence, and he did not subscribe to, indeed he was critical of, the more traditional or orthodox Christian beliefs in accord with which God can be known only through God's special revelation in Jesus, and therefore one must affirm the inspiration of and the authority of Holy Scripture with respect to the truth about human life. and one must then affirm the atoning sacrifice of Jesus as the Son of God or second person of the Trinity. I think he found all of those beliefs something for which there was no reason or evidence. And however sympathetic he was to Christian churches and to evangelical Christians who constituted a substantial part of his constituency, I think it's false to say that he ever confessed Jesus as the Christ himself and therefore never became a Baptist or a Lutheran or Episcopalian or any other recognizable denomination of Christianity.
Now, 67 years before he was president, that might have been something that would have found him with many friends and colleagues because basically almost all of the founders would fit into at least the first part of that. Some were inquirers, some of them just didn't care, and some were deists and some were theists.
Very good, yes.
But in mid to late mid-19th century America, there's a lot of religious stuff going on, pro, con, and otherwise. There's a lot of fervor and there's a lot of religion being used, as he reminds us in the excerpt that you read to us from the first inaugural address. It's not just that both sides pray to the same God. Both sides are Bible readers and filled with Bible readers. Do you get the sense that this added to or was a part of Lincoln's aloneness, that he was able somehow to move up the political ranks despite not participating in that type of God talk?
That's a wonderful question and very insightful comment. As you well know, some of the people Lincoln admired most were those founders of the Republic who preceded him by several decades and who were themselves children of the Enlightenment and accordingly had as much problem with revealed religion as Lincoln did. He was a reader of Thomas Paine and loved the common sense. And he, as you also know, eulogized nobody, with the exception perhaps of Henry Clay, more than he did Thomas Jefferson. So that he certainly must have considered himself akin to the children of the Enlightenment who were founders of the Republic. But that's not quite your question. Your question was whether or not his difference from the evangelical Christianity that so dominated the country in the mid-19th century, whether his differences from them contributed to his sense of loneliness. And I expect that must have been the case. He was certainly thought by many to be an infidel because he didn't confess Jesus as the Christ, because he was not a confessing Christian. He was certainly thought to be an infidel. There was debate about that among people who admired him, but I can't imagine that he didn't have the problem of constantly trying to persuade people that he didn't fit the categories of infidelity or atheism, that he admired Christians even if he couldn't be one of them. And I expect that was a burden he carried. Mm-hmm. When he became president, I think it was the case, so far as I can understand the history, that evangelical Protestantism was a very, very essential part of his own political constituency and certainly helped him swing the 1864 election the second time he was elected as president. And so I can't but imagine he tried to express his sympathy toward Christianity. But I see no evidence that he ever himself said anything that was Christological in character, that would be taken as an affirmation of the Christ.
We're speaking with Franklin Chris Gamwell, Shaler Matthews Distinguished Service Professor in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, which is also his graduate school alma mater. So we know that he's been thinking hard thoughts for a long time throughout his distinguished career. He's the author of many books on moral theory, philosophy, religion, politics, how these things all do or do not come together, and the whole general matter of religion and ethics. We know that a part of why Lincoln was drawn to and kept up with his two Bibles, in a way, Shakespeare and the Bible, the King James Bible, was because, of course, of his famous self-education and just this innate attraction and, of course, genius that allowed him to recognize the importance of these, and not just as tools for writing and for expression, but for thinking. And he would come back over and over, of course, in private life as well as public, and also the whole set of issues around humor. Maybe we can come back to that too. But you raise a couple of small, in number of words, points in your paper that I think are important for people to think about. And one is that obviously around him when he was growing up was not only that poverty, which so appalled him and so caused the frictions between him and his father, and perhaps also heightened the affection that he had for his mother, especially then after she died. But you also point out that because of the world of his father, he would have been exposed to what was then the or a Baptist tradition, and that the role that Calvinism played in that strain of American Baptist belief and practice. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, that's a fascinating part of Lincoln's biography and a fascinating subject of discussion about Lincoln. He seemed to be a fatalist, or at least many people have used that term to describe him. He loved to cite Hamlet and say something like, I've found my life the way Hamlet says. There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them as we will. And after his death, apparently his wife reported to William Herndon, Lincoln's law partner, that she had often heard him say something like, what will be, and no cares of ours will arrest the decree. Whether or not fatalist is the best term for him is debatable, it seems to me. He did certainly believe in God, and certainly after he became president, he much more had in mind a God who seemed to order history by decisions of divine will, the will that was expressed in the events of history, so that you had a kind of personal God who was controlling everything by divine decree. Hence, the appropriate question, it seems to me, is how much, if at all, Lincoln believed in Calvin's doctrine of special providence. Calvin's doctrine of special providence was the doctrine that God's sovereignty did design every event of history in all of its detail. Lincoln certainly would have been exposed to such Calvinist determinism because his father did, both in Kentucky and Indiana, attend churches where that kind of severe Calvinist determinism was preached. And apparently, after Lincoln became president, he became much more of a regular churchgoer, and he attended the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church in Washington, and its pastor, a man named Gurley, Phineas Gurley, was a very sophisticated and thoughtful Calvinist who believed in Calvinistic determination. And so it's quite possible that Lincoln was deeply influenced by Gurley, even while Gurley's sophisticated presentation fit with beliefs that Lincoln long had. So the thought that Lincoln was a believer in divine determination has a lot of power behind it. There are some citations from Herndon where supposedly Lincoln said he thought humans might have a small degree of freedom to modify the environment that shapes them. So there were some qualifications he might have introduced. But nonetheless, the notion that he was deterministic about history seems right. Nonetheless, it never compromised his belief that there was a moral order and it was our responsibility to align ourselves with it. It's noteworthy that the Calvinists who believed most strongly in special providence also tended to have a very demanding moral doctrine, so that the two went together without apparent conflict in the minds of many Calvinists. And the same was with Lincoln. Notwithstanding whatever he thought about divine determinism, he was deeply committed to the fact that humans should discern as best they could what the divine will is and do it.
It's a fascinating question and has been since it was proposed and continues to be so over the centuries, the idea that to overgeneralize, oversummarize, everything is determined, including our own fates. However, we have to do our best to approach that which is the best and that which is good and that which is the will of the Creator. And whether that was done, as some propose, as a way of demonstrating that you were one of the elect, or whether it was done purely because this was the right thing to do. And the important thing, again, as you've indicated here, is not whether Lincoln signed a form saying, "This I believe," but that this was something in his environment that he knew and could, particularly perhaps with the mediation of a sophisticated exponent of it such as Phineas Gurley, that he could feel somewhat comfortable in as a means of his own working things through and a means of expressing things and a means of expressing things with the goal as a politician of bringing people around to that point of view,
yes,
of where the arc,
yes,
of history was going.
Yes, it's at first blush, the two convictions seem contradictory. I mean, if everything is divinely determined, why not eat, drink, and be merry? Why think that there's some obligations we must meet? Lincoln had no problem putting the two together if, in fact, he was, as I'm inclined to think, quite severely a determinist. And I think the way he put them together was, you've already indicated, it was to say that human decision-making is an instrument of divine will and the way through which God controls events, so that we are responsible for making decisions because that is the instrument God uses to affect God's purposes. And those two thoughts went together quite clearly for Lincoln. I think at points it was important for him to think that God controlled events. He's cited somewhere as having said once to somebody that if events did not go the way he wanted, he assumed it was not God's will, meaning that he had misunderstood the arc of history. It's also apparently true that after he wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, his Secretary of State, Seward, said he ought to hold off issuing it because the war was going badly and it would look like an act of desperation, and he should wait until there was a Union victory. And so Lincoln didn't issue it until after Antietam, an ambiguous victory, but close enough.
A victory within the battle, not the total victory.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Exactly right. A victory within
the
war.
Yeah.
A battle victory. And ambiguous as Antietam was, Lincoln took it to be a victory. And he apparently had believed and said that if the Union were successful at Antietam, he would read that to mean God's will wanted him to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So one has the sense that his belief in divine determination was a kind of philosophical and religious support for the difficult, just amazingly harrowing decisions that he had to make as the leader of a nation in that kind of war.
Let's talk a bit about the language that he did use throughout his career and about some of the both the content and the style that he liked to draw upon and was influenced by. One area, of course, is that because of what you're laying out here or reminding us of in terms of God's presence, the Creator's presence, however we want to use the term, in history and acts happening, and also this idea that things are, well, they were at the time extremely dark and with great issues of consequence, not only for the future of the country, but for the future of people's souls. Because if there is this evil among us, which is huge, and it's the enslavement of one set of human beings by another, there are just terrible consequences. Today, maybe we would say they are psychological, but
yes,
but they were moral and they were providential in terms of whatever life people might face after death. Because of all of these things, in part at least, he was very much drawn to an old-fashioned phrase, the Old Testament God. Was that something that was common at that time? Was that something that he found more resonance in in those sections of what might also be called the Hebrew Bible, where, you know, God is acting through these things rather than through the more philosophical and things happening around Jesus' presence on earth.
My suspicion, it's not a whole lot more than that, my suspicion is that he was drawn to the Old Testament God, especially because that was the God of the prophets. And the God of the prophets was a God for whom the relation between commitment or belief, commitment to or belief in this God, the relation between that and the political order was terribly important. Whether that's true in the New Testament is very debatable. There are many scholars who think that, in fact, New Testament Christianity was imbued with the belief that this world was going to end very, very quickly. Paul especially thought this world apparently was going to end very, very quickly. And so there was no point dealing with the social and political order. God was going to deal with that in a very dramatic way and deal with it soon. So the interest in religion and politics, I think, automatically draws people, Lincoln just being one, but many, many others, to the Old Testament's prophets and to the God that they proclaimed.
Interesting, too, that, of course, for the slaves, former slaves, and their non-black allies, I guess people might say today, the Old Testament was so important because not only of the prophetic sections, but, of course, of the Exodus story and of the slaves becoming free. Lincoln, of course, was well aware of these things, but the direct references that one finds in the spirituals of that time and in speeches and writings from Harriet Tubman on through Douglas, Frederick Douglass, etc., those are somewhat different from where he's going with it, which is more that in part because he's speaking to those who can vote. And he's reminding people there's a day of wrath for you all because this God is not friendly when people are doing really bad things.
Yes, that certainly that theme became so deeply apparent in the second inaugural address. Although, interestingly, many of the phrases in the second inaugural address were presaged by things that he had written privately in the years during the war leading up to its conclusion and to 1865. But I think your insight is correct. Whatever the, and it certainly was profound, the relationship that slaves and other African Americans found between the Exodus on the one hand and the quest for freedom in this country in the 19th century, whatever relationship they found there, it was not one that Lincoln tended to draw on, but for reasons probably that you are correct in stating, because he wasn't so much speaking to the slaves as he was trying to speak to the constituency that could eventually pass the 13th Amendment, freeing the slaves. He was a man who, I think, was deeply convinced about the wisdom of popular opinion, at least in the long run. He believed that politicians had the right and responsibility to help shape public opinion, but still he made his decisions with one eye on popular wisdom, and that made him a prudent politician, and he was more interested in saying and doing things that would get the best possible given the circumstances than he was in trying to assert or advocate ideals that he thought it would be futile to pursue at that particular time. So I think you're quite right to say that his references to religion always were made with an eye on whom he was talking to and what he was trying to accomplish.
Our guest is Franklin I. Gamwell, that's G-A-M. W-E-L-L. The program is Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered, a series running from last February through next February, commemorating the 200th anniversary of the birth of our 16th president in 1809. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Patner, and you're listening to 98.7 WFMT Radio in Chicago, and or to WFMT.com.
stars begin to fall.
Oh, sinner, what will you do?
Oh, sinner, what will you do? Oh, sinner, what will you do? When the stars begin to and mountains, you weep for the rocks and mountains, you weep for the rocks and the mountains. When the stars begin to fall,
my Lord, what a morning, my Lord.
Chris Gamwell, you do a reading for us within this paper on Lincoln and the religious question. And even though we've said and you've said this was not something that came out of your direct scholarly pursuits, I hope that it's something that you will publish or post or incorporate into something, because I think there's just food for thought literally in every sentence, and it's not long. So that's also nice. But you alluded earlier in the hour to the use of the phrase, a house divided against itself cannot stand. This, of course, is one of the most famous of Lincoln's utterances. He then unpacks it to talk about a country. Can it be all or one? Can it be half slave and half free? And in fact, we know this speech to this day as the house divided speech. But in fact, that's a direct quotation from another source, and you talk about what that meant to its author and how that may and may not be the same world that Lincoln's working on in his own speech. Maybe you can do a little of that for us now.
I'll do my best. Yes, the House Divided is a wonderful speech. Lincoln says the country cannot endure half slave and half free. He does not expect the country, the nation, to dissolve. He does not expect the house to fall, as he says, but he does expect it will become all one thing or all the other. And that way of putting it at least suggests that the problem is simply you have in the nation two competitive commitments, and you can resolve the problem by choosing one or choosing the other. The house divided metaphor suggests Lincoln had something else in mind. The house divided metaphor in the Gospel of Mark, it's not talking about the division in human communities. It's not talking about a breach within nations. It's talking about a division within the human soul. And Mark's point on my reading goes something like this. We humans are born as creatures of God. We belong to God. And the integrity of our lives is given in loving God with all our hearts and souls and minds and strength, and thereby loving all that God loves, our neighbor as ourselves. And division in the soul occurs when we pretend that something other than God can fill the place that only God can fill. And accordingly, when humans worship or love with all their hearts and souls and minds and strength something other than God, their success, their power, their race, their class, their nation, anything almost can be an idol that is raised up in competition with God. And when it is, there is a division within the soul that can only be resolved by a repenting of the idolatry, because our attachment to God, our belonging to God, cannot be escaped. Now, that suggests that when Lincoln uses the house divided metaphor to talk about the nation being half slave and half free, he's not suggesting that the nation can endure if it makes a choice one way or the other. He, I think, is also insisting that the integrity of the nation is something that can be preserved only by the elimination of slavery. He deeply believed that the moral order and the nature of things was articulated nowhere as purely as in the Declaration of Independence, and therefore deeply believed that the laws of nature and nature's God are such that all are created equal and endowed by their Creator with these inalienable rights, so that equality of all humans was of the essence of the Republic. It was to be a body politic of government by the people, for the people. Slavery was an enemy within. It was the admission of something at fundamental odds with the integrity of the Republic. So as long as some of the states were slave, or all of the states were slave, or any of the states were slave, the Republic was a house divided, because it had admitted an enemy within its own very soul.
There was an immoral inconsistency that ate at the very foundation of each person and each state and the country's house.
Precisely. The metaphor Lincoln often used to talk about it was the metaphor of cancer. Just as cancer is alien to a living body, and if the cancer wins out, the body is wasted, so for Lincoln, slavery is treason to the moral integrity of the Republic. And if slavery persists, the Republic will just as surely be in ruin. So I'm inclined to think that his appeal to the House Divided speech fits in with his view that there is a God who sets a moral order, and that this moral order is specified to politics in the Declaration of Independence, and that slavery must be abolished because it is treason to that moral order.
It just occurs to me, as you're explaining this so well to us, that another person put it in a parallel way, perhaps. I'm thinking of the famous expression, I'm sure said by others before and of course since, but attached to the prize fighter Joe Louis: he can run, but he can't hide. You can run, but you can't hide.
Yes,
and that's sort of what A House Divided is saying.
Yes, exactly.
You have to face up to this. It won't work.
Yes, exactly. It is division in the radical sense. It's the division is like adultery, I'd like to say. I mean, just as the prior marriage sets one's true loyalty, and one becomes an adulterer when one allows someone else to occupy the place that you've already vowed to your betrothed. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of division Lincoln had in mind. Mm-hmm. The Declaration of Independence, government of and by and for the people, was the integrity, and the admission of slavery was adultery.
It doesn't make philosophical or moral sense or spatial sense.
Yes, exactly. He loved to appeal to the book of Genesis for his religious grounding of the Declaration. He thought that for the founders, anything made in the likeness of God, as he put it, was not sent into this world to be trodden on or degraded or imbruted by its fellows. That the book of Genesis, by saying that all humans are made in the image of God, was saying that all are to be treated equally.
And in saying that and in those references, he's also aware of what some people just kind of pass over, is that there are two tellings of that at the very beginning of Genesis, and that one, in a way perhaps to remind us that male and female, he created them, and after we have the Adam and Eve and so on. But this reminder that equal means equal. It doesn't mean kinda.
Yes, exactly. Equal does not mean kinda. I think he also was aware of, I'm not entirely sure of this, but he was aware of a saying by Thomas Jefferson that was of a similar vein. Jefferson said that the mass of mankind was not born with saddles on their backs and a favored few booted and spurred ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. That was the same sense that Lincoln had. One of the reasons I expect he loved Jefferson so much.
You, for the most part, stick with Lincoln, his period, and things that he encountered, believed, or expressed, or might have read. But you also introduce, at least to your lay readers, two observations by Alfred North Whitehead that together seem to be the two sides of the Lincoln penny. The one is religion is what the individual does with his own solitariness. And that, of course, is so much about Lincoln because we have somebody who throughout the career and even when he's, as you say, having to make these dreadful decisions on a day-to-day basis, he is conscious of this self-quest. Who am I? What am I? What am I doing? How can I be best? This professional, we would say perhaps, quest. What is the way to be the right president and to do things right? And then the bigger question, how are we all supposed to move in this direction? But underneath all of that, there's him alone, contemplating, reading, thinking, writing.
Yes, that's the sense in which I think he was a religious inquirer. Whitehead, when he wrote that definition of religion, certainly didn't mean that religion is individualistic or it's privatistic or anything like that. What Whitehead meant was that each of us must decide for ourselves what it is we're going to love with all our hearts and souls and minds and strength. That is the decision that nobody can make for us. That's the solitary decision, and it will inform all the other decisions we take in work and play in public or private life, what we take to be the ground of the ultimate worth and meaning of our lives, and therefore love without reservation. That's the solitary decision, and that's the decision Lincoln was constantly inquiring about. Who is this God that gives ultimate worth to my life so that I can then know how to live it?
Whitehead also said that religion was, at least in part, world loyalty.
I think that's, if we put that in Christian terms, that's another way of saying that if one loves the whole from which we all come and to which we all go, if one loves the all-embracing God who is said to love all the world, then one can only love what God loves and therefore love all the world. So if one's solitary decision is for the God of all-embracing love, then it's a decision to love all the world, and the two are utterly compatible.
There's another way that that world loyalty comes into play in a very strong way in terms of Lincoln's politics. And I think it helps us to understand something that is often used in what I've always thought is a sort of false dichotomy. Was it more important to save the Union or to free the slaves? I think we've all come to understand that, of course, Lincoln had to make certain arguments about why we had to save the Union, because you couldn't free the slaves if you didn't own that part of the country that had the slaves. So how could you free them? And of course, there are tensions, there are backs and forths, there are priorities. But the other important thing that gets forgotten, I think, too often is that we didn't need to save the Union, and Lincoln didn't become almost fanatic about this just because somebody said we had a Union or because there were economic forces or because it seemed symmetrical, but because we were still a young nation, we had to remind the rest of the world that democracy was a real thing and was a modern thing and was a contemporary thing because it was an ancient thing, and that if we collapsed into two countries or five countries or whatever, 50 states or however many there were at the time, we would play into the hands of this idea, oh, no, you need tyrants, kings, despots, or at least nobility in order to have a polity.
Excellent. As you know, there are certainly many people who think that Lincoln's concern with slavery was incidental, that he really was a racist and he didn't really care about freeing the slaves. What he cared about was vindicating the American experiment in democracy against those European detractors who thought that you needed some measure of aristocratic or monarchical control in order to protect the community against the instability of popular enthusiasms. I don't doubt that Lincoln was interested in vindicating the democratic experiment in America. But if it's true that he took the presence of slavery to be a treason to that very democratic experiment, then vindicating democracy or popular government in this country and eliminating slavery become inseparable, two sides of the same coin. And I'm more inclined to think that's the case. I think Lincoln's hatred of slavery was with him very early on in his public life and persisted throughout his presidency, even if he often talked about the war for reasons you mentioned, that a too ready commitment to abolition would have jeopardized the coalition he required in order to restore the Union.
This has been a fascinating and enlightening discussion, and we could continue it, and I hope we'll have opportunities to continue discussion of other topics with Franklin Gamwell in the future. I'm wondering, though, for today, if maybe to round this out, you might read from the end of your talk, including the references that you make to the second inaugural.
I do love the second inaugural. But even if one questions who Lincoln was earlier in his life or finds his most significant legacy elsewhere, can there be any doubt about the very core of his convictions in 1865 as he delivered his second inaugural address? Both parties deprecated war, but one would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. If we shall assume that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war, as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue, until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. What Lincoln says here perhaps confirms a sense that all is providentially determined, likely conveys his brooding over the seemingly inscrutable purposes of the God who has allowed this awesome bloodshed, clearly expresses his conviction that civil war was the recompense for the Republic's duplicitous constitution,
and surely seeks to underscore the complicity of the entire country in the offense, thereby leading to Lincoln's concluding plea for malice toward none and charity for all. But whatever else is within these almost incredible words, they give unrivaled voice to the depth with which slavery is condemned by the ultimate nature of things. Slavery caused the war, and whatever the price exacted before the war shall pass, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Lincoln's second inaugural alone, on my accounting, provides full security for the conclusion that no other president surpasses his wisdom and eloquence on the relation between politics and religion.
Franklin I. Gamwell, reading from Lincoln and the Religious Question. Chris Gamwell is Shaler Matthews Distinguished Service Professor of Religious Ethics, the Philosophy of Religions and Theology in the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. He also was, for 10 years, the Dean of the Divinity School of the University of Chicago back in the 1980s, and he's also an ordained Presbyterian minister. Chris Gamwell, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Lincoln with us today.
My pleasure to be here, Mr. Patman. Thank you.
Abraham Lincoln Reconsidered is a co-production of WFMT and the Chicago History Museum. The associate producer and producing engineer for the series is Matt DeStefano. Generous funding comes from Motorola Foundation. And we'd like to thank our good friend Tom Budell, who first alerted us to Chris Gamwell's interest in Abraham Lincoln after Tom heard Mr. Gamwell give a talk, the talk that we have actually been talking about today, before the visiting committee to the Divinity School of the University of Chicago back in May. Let us know what you think about our Lincoln series. You can drop us a note at lincoln@wfmt.com. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for this series. We'll see you next week.